Hi, I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
And I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk shop with obsessive home cooks everywhere. This week, we're talking about mixed vegetable sautés and candied nuts. We've also got Marisa's interview with Tracy Medeiros. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week. Actually, before we get into food news, just a reminder that the fall Local Mouthful potluck is coming up on November 11th. We're cooking from Deborah Madison's books this year. And if you want to be on the invite list, just leave a comment to that effect in the show notes for this episode. Okay, now on to the news.
All right. So a couple weeks ago, we talked about how the Philly Food and Farm Fest had been canceled. And there's been sort of more news that has been rippling out from that because it is it's become public knowledge that the Fair Food Organization, which is the people who organized the Philly Farm and Food Fest, they shut down the farm stand 6 months ago, owing a lot of vendors a lot of money. And those people were promised that they would be paid back with the revenue from the Philly Food and Farm Fest. And now that it's not happening, there is a hole, a gap. Where is this money going to come from?
Right. And I think that most people became aware of the more details about this in the recent Philadelphia Inquirer article, which we'll post a link to. We learned that a lot of our favorite farmers are owed money from a few hundred to a few thousand dollars to $5,000, yeah, which is a lot for a farmer.
Absolutely. And it's really frustrating because, you know, as a, you know, just as a person, a member of the public who purchased at Fair Food at the farm stand, the assumption was this money was going to those vendors, mm-hmm, you know, that we paid, you know, because none of that food was grocery store cheap. You
nope.
know, you paid a premium to shop there with the assumption that you were supporting local food. And so the fact that that money didn't go to the people who were supplying that local food is really hard to, you know, wrap your head around and frustrating.
Yeah. From the time that Dan started working in Center City about 2 years ago to when the farm stand closed about 6 months ago, we were buying a lot of our food there. That was a regular stop. Dan went there a couple of times a week for apples and yogurt and salad greens and kombucha and, you know, lots of stuff.
Yeah. I walked over there probably once every 2 weeks to, you know, stock up on things.
I used to buy my Thanksgiving turkey there every year.
I know. Me too. Yeah.
Which, I mean, I've been getting people asking me where to go. I mean, it's a real hole. But yeah, anyway, the assumption was that the money was going to the farmers, and it's quite disconcerting,
yeah,
to learn that it isn't.
Yeah. And
or wasn't.
And it's, you know, all told, it's like $50,000. And that's a lot of money to make up for people. And especially because this year was so terrible. It was a bad growing season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really wet. It wasn't hot when it needed to be hot. It was too hot when it wasn't needed to be hot. There was too much water. And so everyone had a terrible year. I've talked to multiple farmers who just keep saying, I'm just ready for the hard freeze because I just want this year to be wiped away and mm-hmm, get to start clean. And, you know, that, you know, if they're owed a couple thousand dollars, that's the difference between being able to make it or not sometimes.
Right. I know a lot of our listeners are here in Philadelphia. Hi, local listeners. There are ways that you can try to help. Philly Food Works, someone who is involved with Philly Food Works on the leadership level, has started a GoFundMe campaign to try to help farmers out.
It's someone who used to work at Fair Food.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah. So it's Anne, and she was one of the managers at the farm stand for a long time. And so I think that she feels pretty invested in making sure that these people mm-hmm, are paid back.
So that's a good way to directly help the farmers at this time when they need it. Another way to do it is to just like buy their stuff elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know,
ideally directly from them.
Right. Yes. I've said to Sue Miller, who has been on the show and is the cheese maker owner at Bertrand Real Farms, that I am going to buy cheese, even though, you know, I'm trying to keep cheese to a to a minimum, it seems like, for a good cause. So
yeah.
Anyway, we'll post a link to the article. We'll post a link to the GoFundMe campaign. And we hope that if you guys have ideas about how to support our local food community, you'll chime in on the comments. Kind of a bummer of a story, but one of the best parts of the local food community here in Philly is I think we really try to stick together.
Yeah.
And hopefully there'll be a happier 2019 for these folks.
Absolutely. Okay, so speaking of local produce and vegetables and farmers, let's talk a little bit about a mixed vegetable saute, which, you know, is sort of three words. You string them together. They're not all that descriptive until you start to dig down. And I wanted to talk about this topic because last night for dinner, I was looking in the fridge and I had some protein and I was making polenta and
kind of protein?
I had some scallops. We did polenta and scallops. I got them at the farmer's market.
I know you like those.
They're so good. And yeah, they're just delicious. And I needed a vegetable. And I had a tiny head of cabbage. I had some onions. I had some Swiss chard. And no one of those things was going to be enough to be a satisfying, like, veggie side. And so I started by sauteing the onion. And then I was like, well, I'll cut up the Swiss chard bottoms and get them soft. And then I looked at it and I was like, there's no way that this is going to be sort of enough. And I grabbed that little head of cabbage and sliced it up. And one of the things that, and then I finally added the Swiss chard leaves. And it was really satisfying because you had the sweetness from the onions. The cabbage kind of gave it, started to caramelize a little bit. So it gave it some heft and a little bit of that sweet caramelization as well. And then the Swiss chard leaves brought in kind of that deeper, slightly bitter green flavor.
Vegetal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so the balance of the dish was really great. And it made me start to think about sort of other combos, especially this time of year, you know, where you might have defaulted to a salad in the spring or the summer. Like, now I want my vegetables warm. And so, you know, I thought about how you could do something similar with shredded Brussels sprouts and, you know, maybe little sweet potato cubes. Like, there's just a number of ways that you can go about creating something similar out of kind of the motley assortment you might have gotten in your CSA.
I like to throw something a little sweet into the mix like that, like raisins or apples, like little apple cubes. Yeah. I feel like that makes it, and of course, I always like to finish something like that with vinegar. I don't know if you, or lemon juice.
Yeah, I did. I gave mine a little squirt of lemon juice to kind of brighten it a bit.
And especially when you're making a really simple protein like scallops that doesn't require like a lot of fuss or time, you can sort of put the extra minutes in to cutting up a few other vegetables. And I don't mix my vegetables together as often as I would probably enjoy.
Yeah.
Even just adding the onion really takes it from kind of an afterthought to more of a assembled dish.
It's true.
Do you have any other favorite combinations?
I really love doing carrots and cabbage. That's another one, maybe with some onions. And sometimes, you know, this one was a stovetop dish, but there have been times when I've done like a carrot and cabbage braise in the oven.
I love braised cabbage.
Oh my God, it's so good. And so I'll like really finely slice the carrots and I'll start them on the stovetop, you know, in either a little olive oil or butter, and then add the cabbage and maybe a little chicken stock and put a lid on it and then slide the whole thing into the oven. So the carrots get really sweet, the cabbage kind of melts, and it's a really kind of savory, slightly drippy vegetable that you can pour over like a baked potato, or like in my case last night, that polenta was a really good kind of base, receiving ground for a saucy, savory vegetable.
I love polenta. I haven't made it yet this, I mean, it's only been cold for like a week.
It's true.
But I want to make all of the cold weather things.
I know. Yeah. It was the first time I'd made it in months. And it was just as kind of satisfying and easy as I wanted it to be.
Do you find you have like seasonal forgetfulness when the weather changes and then you're like, I forgot how to make oatmeal?
Yes, absolutely.
As we were talking about before this podcast started, I sort of forgot how to make my butternut squash soup. It's like a learning curve every year.
I know. The same things kind of slide off your radar, and then when you come back to them, it's like the same way I feel about my winter wardrobe. Like, I forget what I have because I haven't even looked at those clothes in 6 months. And like my winter culinary wardrobe is much the same. It's like I have to remember, relearn what I know how to do.
That's where we are right now.
Yeah.
Well, let's do a how do you make that?
Yeah.
And I want to talk about candied nuts.
An excellent skill to have in your repertoire.
Believe I was at a restaurant recently. I cannot put my finger on exactly which restaurant, but they had had a salad which had sweet little candied pecans all over it, which were, I thought they were so good. And then, you know how Dan and I often default to salad and potatoes for dinner?
Yeah.
Well, we had no potatoes. So I was like, I really have to make this salad special to make up for the lack of potatoes and being only salad for dinner. So I decided I wanted to try to candy some nuts, and I realized that I had never candied nuts before in my life, which seems odd. Like, I've done so much cooking. How is it possible that I have never really candied nuts? So I thought it had to be very easy, and what I did was I put a handful of pecans in a bowl. I drizzled it with oil, and then I sprinkled some salt and sugar on it. And then I put it on a Silpat lined baking sheet and into the oven at, I believe, 350.
Uh-huh.
Nothing happened.
No.
The sugar sort of just fell off the nuts. It never really got melty. And I thought, I need to salvage this somehow. So then I took it out of the oven. I put it back in the bowl. And I mixed it up with some maple syrup. Then I put it back on the Silpat, put it back in the oven. And then it finally started to, I got usable candied nuts out of the deal.
Yeah.
But I was like, clearly I don't know how to do this. And then I turned to some books and some YouTube videos and I tried to figure it out. And now I have a plan for how I'll do it next time. But I thought you could tell us how you would do it.
So I like a two-stage candied nut process where I'll put them in a pan first and I'll dry toast them.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, in a small like butter warmer or something like that, I'll start making the glaze where I'll melt together either a little bit of butter and brown sugar or butter and honey or butter and maple syrup. And so as the nuts toast in the dry pan and once they kind of start to smell fragrant, that's and I also have the oven going to like 350 or 400, depending on how sort of fast and loose I want to play. So once the nuts are nice and toasted, I pour the prepared like butter syrup over top, stir it to coat, and then tumble everything out onto like a Silpat lined baking sheet and then roast them until they kind of bubble and it caramelizes a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I take it out and let them cool and break them apart.
Yeah.
So I know that some people are like, well, why do you need the two? I just find it's easier to control in the oven. Like you could do it all in a skillet, but it would be I feel like I have less control that way.
After watching a bunch of YouTube videos about this, I think that my next attempt will be toast the nuts in the skillet, then add sugar, and then just stir over like moderate low heat as the sugar melts and adheres to the nuts. And then while they're hot, spread them out on a parchment or Silpat lined surface to let them cool and like sort of just break them up with a fork.
Yeah.
And we'll see how that goes.
I do think yours will produce more of a candied nut and mine produces more of a glazed nut, which have slightly different textures. So like a glazed nut is going to be a little bit shinier, a little bit richer, whereas the candied nut, you get more of like that just sugar coating on the outside.
Yeah. I don't, which, this is new territory for me. So I have to explore. And of course, I always add salt. I want it to be sweet and salty.
Yeah. You really, once it comes out of the oven or it's on the baking sheet, that's when I always hit it with some like really flaky salt.
This whole topic reminded me of your jam glazed nuts.
Those are so good.
Which will be in your forthcoming cookbook, correct?
Yes.
When's the release date?
I think it's the first Tuesday in April.
Is it available for pre-order yet?
It is, although it doesn't have a pretty cover. They're having some cover difficulties.
Okay.
So it's a ugly cover right now. But
still, it's never too soon to pre-order.
True enough.
Maurice's next book called
The Food in Jars Kitchen.
Yeah, that'll be.
I'm excited about it. I feel good. I did the final edits last week. And
jam glazed nuts for everyone.
Yeah.
Okay, and now we have your interview with Tracy Medeiros.
Our guest today is Tracy Medeiros. She is a cookbook author, recipe developer, and food writer who has made it her purpose to celebrate the food of Vermont. Her fourth book, called The Vermont Non-GMO Cookbook, was recently published, and she's here today to tell us about it. Welcome, Tracy.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am so glad you're here. I feel like we've been working on getting you on the show for months and months, and it's finally happened. So the Vermont Non-GMO Cookbook is gorgeous. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for saying it's gorgeous, first of all. And the Vermont Non-GMO Cookbook focuses on the non-GMO and organic elements of the food system throughout the entire state of Vermont. And the book's emphasis is on food transparency. Know what's in your food. And I've simplified the complexity of the movement with recipes that include ingredients which do not contain genetically modified organisms. And all of the farms that contributed recipes for the cookbook are certified organic. And the food producers are either certified organic or non-GMO. And all of the chefs that are featured in the book, as well as the restaurants, feature organic and non-GMO on their menus.
That's terrific. You know, it's interesting here in Philly, we don't have, I don't feel like we have as much of an emphasis on non-GMO. So it was really interesting to read through your book and see what a large part of the food system it has become. Now, I'm curious, why did the non-GMO angle speak so strongly to you?
Well, as you mentioned just a few minutes ago, I've written 4 cookbooks, and my second cookbook, the Vermont Farm Table Cookbook, started the ball rolling for me with the non-GMO movement. While I was writing the book and doing research, I kept hearing the term non-GMO while speaking with folks who leaned in that direction. And it really piqued my interest. And as time went on, it became stronger. And I met more farmers and more food producers and chefs who followed that practice. And it just really inspired me. And I'm not quite sure if folks know this, but Vermont became the first U.S. state to pass the historic GMO food labeling law, which has now forever changed the way Americans eat. And even though this law was nullified, I really felt it was important to continue with this project because folks really want to know what's in their food.
So what are some easy things that people can do to keep GMO foods out of their diet?
Well, when shopping for non-GMO food, look for the USDA organic label because organic does not allow GMOs in food or animal feed. And also buy non-GMO certified foods. The non-GMO project focuses specifically on GMOs, and you'll see that really neat butterfly on boxes and on cans. And basically, it's a verification mark that indicates that a product has achieved compliance with the non-GMO project standards. So that's what I would recommend.
Sounds great. So, what can people expect when they pick up a copy of this book? Are the recipes sort of complex or otherworldly? I wonder if people will be sort of like, well, I don't even know where to start with GMOs. So tell us a little bit about what to expect.
Well, my goal was to make this as carefree and as easy as possible because folks tend to, when they hear GMOs, non-GMOs, it gets a little daunting for them. So when I created this cookbook, I wanted it to be very friendly. And there's something for everyone in this book. So if you are a beginner cook, there's easy recipes in the book. If you are more advanced, there's some recipes for you as well. There's something if you're a seafood eater, a vegetarian, a meat lover. But it's very friendly and it's not intimidating. And I do that with all of my books. And I also make sure that all of the recipes are tested. I either hire a recipe tester or two, depending on the project. And I test recipes as well. Unfortunately, I don't have time to test every single one because I'm also writing the book as well. But I make sure to try everything. And I have meetings with my recipe testers. There's a recipe testing form that each recipe tester has to follow. And we have conversations about the recipes. How does it look? Is it visually appealing? How does it taste? Does it need to cook longer, less? Do we need a garnish? So my goal for this book was to make it fun. So when you talk about GMOs, you're not intimidated by it.
Well, and I think you've really achieved that. It, like I was saying earlier, it is a beautiful book. Like the quality of the paper is beautiful. The photography is beautiful. And then the recipes are really, they feel accessible and interesting. And once you're inside the book, you forget that it has sort of this message and you just want to make the food. So I think that you really succeeded there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So are there any particular favorites of yours in the book that you'd suggest that people try?
Oh, absolutely. Especially too with Thanksgiving coming up, Brussels sprouts with a creamy sriracha dipping sauce. It's easy to prepare. It's a great way to get your daily allotment of veggies. And the dipping sauce is so creamy and spicy and versatile. So any leftover dipping sauce, which I doubt you'll have any, but if you do, you can put it on burgers or dip your fries in it. And if you love fried calamari, it's amazing. Then there's a Northern Lake fish chowder, which is fabulous. It's sweet, and yet there's crisp flavors from the hard apple cider, and it's just the perfect counterpoint to the smoky flavors of the lake fish, and it's smooth and velvety texture from the cream and the fish is just amazing, and it's so pretty as well. And then also there's a great apple raspberry pie since it's apple season, and it's beautiful and it's rustic, and it just, the raspberries just pair so beautifully with the apple, and you can have a dollop of whipped cream on it or ice cream or just eat it as is. I like to have it sometimes in the morning for breakfast when I'm running late, and I tell myself, well, at least I'm having apples and raspberries and kind of like not think about the pie aspect of it. So I would definitely recommend those three. They're simple, beautiful, and I think your guests would like it as well.
Oh, they sound great. I do love the combination of apples and raspberries, so I'm definitely going to earmark that one for myself as well.
Great.
So you're coming to Philadelphia later this month to teach a class.
I
want to hear more. How can people sign up? What are you going to make? I feel like it's going to be a class that a lot of our listeners will be really excited about.
Well, thank you. Well, this is my second time going back to Audre Claire Cook. They invited me back again, and I'm so honored. I'm going to be there in November, Saturday, November 17th. And if folks want to learn more about what how to sign up, they can go to the website, which is www.audreyclairecook.com. And the class, if you click on their classes and scroll down to Saturday, November 17th, you'll see mine. And from 6 to 8, I will be preparing a four-course menu. And I'll start off with maple kale salad with toasted almonds and some wonderful cheese and rustic croutons. And it's just a simple, light salad with subtle layers of flavor. And then you have that delicate sweetness from the maple syrup and the maple shavings. And it just pairs so nicely with the slightly citrus notes from the lemon, as well as the hints of nuttiness from the almonds. And then the second course will be this beautiful crostini with arugula. And it just has some peppery notes to it. And it's also great on chicken and fish, as well as if you make a classic grilled cheese sandwich, it just adds a nice unique twist to it. And then for the third course, I'll be making this fresh pasta dish with fennel cream, Italian sausage, and this wonderful sheep milk cheese. And I fried some sage leaves and I tossed that in there. And it's just a beautiful contrast with the green leaves, as well as just the Italian sausage and the creamy fennel sauce, is just to die for. And then I finish with a maple pudding. And maple pudding is just an excellent example of how much maple and cream just elevate each other. So it's just this really smooth, delicious dessert. And I'm probably going to make a few extras because I'm sure folks will want more. I know in my household they do.
That sounds so good. So where can people find more information about your books and where else you'll be traveling? Because, you know, our listeners are all across the country. We're based in Philly and we have a lot of listeners here, but there might be some folks in other places that want to hear about where they could find you.
Sure. If you go to my website, www.tracymedieros.com, I have all the information there where I tour. Also, there's recipes on there. So, for instance, if someone out there wants to maybe make a Thanksgiving dish, I have a wonderful roasted root vegetable and artisan handcrafted sausage stuffing. It's all a tongue twister there. Sausage stuffing. And it's fabulous. And it's just rustic looking with all these subtle layers. They can go there and get recipes as well, learn about my other books, and learn about where I'll be.
Well, perfect. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us today. And if you're in Philadelphia and you want to take Tracy's class, it's November 17th at Audre Claire Cook's, and I know she'd love to have you. So thanks again, Tracy.
Thank you so much for having me.
In what I'm loving this week, I want to talk about other people's podcasts.
All right. I love it. I'm a podcast booster.
I'm not sure how this crossed my path. I think it might have been on social media, but I've been listening to this podcast called The Dinner Sisters Podcast. I know I mentioned it to you. Have you had a chance to give it a listen?
You know what? I haven't. I added it to my subscriptions and I just haven't I've been going to more exercise classes than going running, so I haven't been listening to as many podcasts.
Well, just like people are always telling us that they listen to this podcast when they're cooking, I've been listening to the Dinner Sisters while I've been cooking.
Awesome.
The Dinner Sisters are Betsy and Kate, and the reason I really like their podcast is it kind of reminds me of our podcast. I was like, oh, this is Betsy and Kate are doing for me what I hope Marisa and I are doing for other people. And I mean, they have a different format. What they do specifically is they review three recipes. There are usually like recipes available out there on the internet. Recently, they've done like Ina Garten's roasted fish with like a mustard creme fraiche topping. Ooh. They talked about, I can't remember where this one came from, but like a Japanese cutlet. They've talked about, grilling recipes. They did a bunch of grilling recipes in September. They did a semifreddo, and they have a Facebook page where people talk about the recipes, and, I cannot recall which Dinner Sister, but one of them makes a shopping list in case they have a newsletter and they send out the recipes in advance. And then if you want to make them, they'll send you they have a shopping list, which, I mean, I haven't made any of these recipes yet. I just am a spectator. But it's been really fun for me to enjoy the fruits of someone else's food podcast that I dig. Because, you know, I don't really like a lot of food podcasts as much as I love food. But this one, I think, is just really a sweet podcast. The thing that is different about ours and theirs is they are, in my mind, they're like the Local Mouthful listener.
Uh-huh.
They are avid home cooks, but not professionals.
Yeah.
So it's funny to hear all of their shortcuts and substitutions, things that strike them as too much, you know, like things that strike them as unrealistic. It's all good information for me as a recipe developer. So I've just really been enjoying that. So I wanted to share it with you guys because I think if you like this show, you'll like that show too.
Yeah.
And
I'm excited. I need to listen.
Yeah, I kind of want to like send them some of my recipes because I want them to talk about me, but I'm afraid they're not going to like my recipes because they rate every recipe.
Oh no!
Like they give it stars. Like,
huh?
So that's a little scary from a recipe developer standpoint. And I especially hate when they give stuff stars or like when they take shortcuts or like don't do things that the recipe calls for. I feel like that's not totally fair.
Yeah, you can't give something a star rating if you didn't follow the full-on recipe.
Yeah. So, but still, it's a lot of the stuff that they make sounds really good, and I want to make it. And it's just fun. That's all I have to say about it, really, is it's just fun. They keep me company in the kitchen when I'm cooking. And obviously, I can't listen to our podcast for fun because I've already had this conversation with you. but with them, it's like fresh food talk.
Yeah.
It's also 30 minutes. So I would say there's plenty of room in your life for both Local Mouthful and Dinner Sisters. Give us a listen give them a listen.
Awesome.
And I don't think you're listening, Betsy and Kate. I don't think you're Local Mouthful listeners, but maybe you will be after I send you an email about this and tell you we talked about your show.
Well, there you go. I love it. You know, as food podcasters, we should all be friends.
And on the topic of podcast, do you want to take 1 second before we go to tell people?
Yes.
How to tell a friend about the show?
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things we've learned as we've done this podcast is there are a lot of people out there who love food and love to cook, but they don't know how to listen to podcasts. And so we encourage you, if you have a friend or a family member or a neighbor or even just an acquaintance that you think would really enjoy Local Mouthful, we encourage you to take their phone, ask them to unlock it for you, and then show them how to subscribe and listen to podcasts, because you're going to make their life better. You're going to help us grow our Local Mouthful community, and everyone is just going to have a slightly more delicious life because of it. So
yeah, subscribe them to Local Mouthful. And if you want to give them a bonus podcast, subscribe them to the Dinner Sisters.
There you go. You'll be doing them a double set of favors. And you know what? I think that's it for this episode of Local Mouthful. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. Sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.